Central Time. I'm Jake Carlisle-Larson.
And I'm Chris Molina. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll talk about what rural economic development looks like in Wisconsin.
First, it's time for our weekly look at the top news in national politics. Results are in from last night's primaries in Arizona and Florida. The Democratic National Committee is making changes to its superdelegate system, and those in Washington and around the country are remembering the late Senator John McCain and what his passing means for politics.
And you can let us know what you think about McCain's legacy at 800-642-1234. Do you think politicians have something to learn from McCain's career? If you found yourself in disagreement with McCain's politics, were there any areas that you found common ground? If you're a Republican, did his reputation as a maverick bother you? And what do you think about his rocky relationship with President Trump? Give us a call now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org.
Scott Wong is a senior reporter at The Hill, where he covers House Republicans. Scott, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
So first, let's look at the primaries that happened last night. We just mentioned that they were in Florida and Arizona. Let's start with the governor's race in Florida in particular. That is shaping up to be a contest between two ends of the political spectrum. How did this race play out last night?
Definitely. You had on the Republican side Ron DeSantis win the nomination, and he is a lawmaker in the House who is backed by President Trump. He won President Trump's endorsement, and that helped propel him through the primary. And he's also a founding member of the very conservative House Freedom Caucus that's led by Mark Meadows and Jim Jordan. And so he's extremely close to the president and conservatives in the House. He will be matched up against Tallahassee Mayor Andrew Gillum, who is backed by Bernie Sanders. And so you have a Trump-backed candidate on the Republican side and a Bernie Sanders-backed candidate on the Democratic side. Andrew Gillum is an African-American gentleman. He is a liberal, although he did support Hillary Clinton back in 2016, but a very interesting matchup, and at least if Gillum proves successful in November, he will make history as the first African-American governor of the state of Florida.
Now, both of these candidates in particular were kind of upsets to sort of established parties in the state. Andrew Gillum, as you just mentioned, beat Gwen Graham, who is a former congresswoman. She's more moderate. And Ron DeSantis beat Adam Putnam, who is also moderate and serves as Florida's commissioner of agriculture. These are two people that have been involved in Florida politics for a long time. What is that signal to the respective party leadership there?
I think in terms of Gillum, who was outspent, I think, 5-1, he was up against, as you mentioned, Gwen Graham, who's the daughter of Bob Graham, the former Florida governor and senator, really somebody who represented the establishment. Andrew Gillum, backed by Bernie Sanders, sort of captured the energy on the left, and we are seeing across the country in various races the Democratic Party shifting to the left, with people like Alexandria Cortez up in New York beating Joe Crowley in that primary. In terms of Ron DeSantis, I think our takeaway is that President Trump's endorsement does matter in many of these races. We're seeing it time and time again when President Trump does weigh in. Usually that candidate comes out on top. Not always, but for the most part, he is extremely popular in Florida. Obviously, he has his property down in Florida. It's a state that he won, and in at least among Florida Republicans, Donald Trump is extremely popular, and his endorsement went a long way in this GOP primary.
Now, there were also primaries for U.S. House seats in Florida's 27th and 26th congressional districts. They're both held by Republicans currently, but those districts voted pretty strongly Democratic in the 2016 presidential election. How could these kind of shake it up a little?
Well, in the case of you know, people like Carlos Curbelo, who's one of the Republican congressmen down in the Miami area who won his nomination yesterday. You know, he is somebody who is tacking to the middle. He is very pro-immigration, obviously, with the big immigrant communities down in Miami. He's somebody that frequently speaks out against President Trump on issues like global warming and immigration. And so this is sort of the question for candidates all across the country is, how much do you stand up to the president if you're a Republican in a vulnerable sort of situation and in a swing district like Carlos Curbelo is in? How much do you stand up to the president and push back? There's always a risk that if you push back too much, the president is then going to lash out at you or, you know, endorse a primary challenger or, you know, take resources and funds away from you. So there's always sort of this delicate balancing act for Republicans, you know, as they stand up to the president.
Now, I mean, we could spend probably the rest of our time talking about Florida, but let's also now look at Arizona, which also has been, you know, kind of at the top of everyone's conversations right now politically, because there was a race for Republican Senator Jeff Flake's seat that is up in November. We had Sheriff Joe Arpaio, who you might know as someone who was recently granted a pardon by President Trump, has been a big supporter of Trump. He was in the race. He didn't win. Martha McSally, who people are, it seems as though the GOP is sighing a little bit of a breath of relief there. She ultimately won with 52% of the vote. What kind of race did she run compared to, you know, Sheriff Arpaio?
Martha McSally is the candidate that establishment Republicans in Washington wanted because they believe she is the only person that can defeat Kyrsten Sinema, the Democratic nominee, in the general election as Arizona shifts more and more to the middle, as it becomes more diverse with the increasing Latino population, you know, as the Phoenix metropolitan area grows. And so she was seen as somebody who could take on Kyrsten Sinema. It is going to be one of the marquee races in the country. It will give Arizona its first female senator in history. We have a female on both sides, and so this will be a historic election. I think it's interesting, Arizona and Florida races were sort of determined on the same day. Both of the Florida governor's race and the Arizona Senate race will be two of the top races that people will be watching in November.
Now, it struck me as, you know, I was doing research for this, that the three GOP candidates that were running for Senator Flake's seat, you know, they didn't seem to align very much with now late Senator John McCain. They seem to embrace President Trump. Are we seeing kind of what you were talking about with Florida earlier, candidates who are looking more towards the president for approval here?
Definitely. All three of them, McSally, Sheriff Arpaio, and Kelly Ward, have relationships with the president. McSally has worked with the president on a number of issues, most specifically defense issues. Kelly Ward was an early endorser of the president and had been seeking a reciprocal endorsement from the president for months and months. Sheriff Arpaio, as you know, was also an early supporter of President Trump and received a pardon from the president. And so these are all three people who are sort of vying for the president's affection and endorsement. In the end, the president, advised by many people, held back and actually did not weigh in on who he preferred in that race. But establishment and campaign Republicans were telling the president, we really think McSally is the only person that can hold that seat for the Republican Party, which is extremely important because, you know, with McCain's passing, there's only a 50-49 majority that Republicans have. And so a single seat flipping could flip the entire control of the United States Senate. And so every seat will count in November. And right now, Republicans are defending both chambers of Congress.
So I want to move on to John McCain. He passed away this Saturday. He's being remembered by those in Washington and around the country. Let's take a listen to what his friend, Senator Lindsey Graham, said on the Senate floor yesterday.
If you want to help the country, be more like John McCain. I believe there's a little John McCain in all of us. And the little of John McCain, practiced by a lot of people, can make this a really great nation.
You know, we've been hearing a lot of commendation for Senator McCain. You know, really quickly, what do you think his legacy is going to be, I guess, as people keep talking about it moving forward?
Well, everyone in the Capitol knew the senator because he took time to talk to everybody in the Capitol, including myself and other reporters. He would, you know, answer every single question that you asked of him until you had no more questions to ask him. And that was very rare in the United States Capitol, where a number of some of the younger senators, you know, sort of flee from reporters now or just refer you to their communications director. So he was somebody who took the time, you know, and made you feel important and that your voice and your questions were important. I think in terms of legislative policy, he was, you know, it's sort of an end of an era because he was one of the old lions of the Senate who reached across the aisle and worked with Democrats, including Ted Kennedy, you know, and Russ Feingold on campaign finance reform. And so that sort of bipartisanship, that camaraderie, certainly, you know, doesn't exist as it used to exist decades ago. And I think with the passing of John McCain, a lot of people are wondering whether it's just sort of the Senate will descend into, you know, more partisan warfare. So, you know, of course, he has his military career, and that is unrivaled among lawmakers. And as we're seeing this week with all of the pomp and circumstance regarding his memorial services, both in Arizona today and in Washington, D.C. later this week, I mean, it's almost like, you know, the type of ceremonies that are reserved for a president of the United States. And I think, you know, because every single American knew who John McCain was, a lot of people revere him, you know, like he was the president of the United States. So it's been very touching to watch all of these images and hear all of these heartfelt condolences.
We are talking with Scott Wong right now. He's a senior reporter at The Hill. We're looking at the top political news of the week, and we are going to continue this conversation about John McCain in just a second.
And you can share your thoughts about John McCain's legacy at 800-642-1234. Whether you're a Democrat or a Republican, what did you admire about McCain, and what frustrated you? And do you think bipartisanship and respectful dialogue is still viable for politicians? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org.
Now we are picking up our talk with Scott Wong, senior reporter at The Hill. We are going to be talking about John McCain for just a little bit. You can call in at 800-642-1234. And let's go to one of our callers now. We have Charlie in Milwaukee who wants to chime in on Senator McCain. Hi, Charlie.
Oh, thanks for taking my call. My comment about John McCain and someone who had voted for him previously is that, you know, he seemed to be someone who was telling you the truth. And his disagreement with Donald Trump or Trumpism appears to be due to the fact that you have people on both sides, Donald Trump versus John McCain, who try to tell it the way it is, or at least appear to be telling it as it is, and not the way that the media wants to sugarcoat things. So I think that's where the new social media, the Twittering and everything else seems to favor Donald Trump and the hyper-partisanship that might not be the best thing for the country, but we do tend to go with someone that's going to fit the times and appear to tell us the truth. People are thirsting for people to tell them the truth.
Charlie, thank you so much for that call. And Scott, you know, Charlie is hitting on something pretty particular, which is people have been lauding Senator McCain as being kind of a lion in the Republican Party and just being a lion of a statesman anyway. And then we have this kind of new brand of politics with President Trump. How did they, I mean, we know of their disagreements, to put it mildly, but how did this interplay work with them?
Well, John McCain never supported Donald Trump, did not believe he was qualified to be president, and certainly made that known. In terms of policy, John McCain, as you remember, with the thumbs down vote on Obamacare repeal, essentially killed the Republican efforts and Donald Trump's efforts to repeal Obamacare. And that was sort of a dagger through the heart for the Republican Party when John McCain did that. But that was sort of his reputation as a maverick that was willing to buck his own leadership and buck his own president and do what he believed was right. I think that's sort of one of the big takeaways from McCain's life is he was a man of conviction. And, you know, with all of his faults and errors, and he was the first one to admit he made mistakes in his life and in his political career. But I think that's what a lot of people admired about him.
So, you know, as people are now remembering Senator McCain, and, you know, as we talked about those primaries a little bit earlier, that McCain was known for moments of bipartisanship, not all the time, but that he would work across the aisle. Is this going to be something that we're seeing more of a more rare occurrence given our current political climate?
Yeah, I definitely think so, because, you know, most Republicans now with Donald Trump in the White House are falling in line. You're seeing at least looking at the Senate, the senators who stood up to Donald Trump either have retired or have gone silent. There's very few now that you can look to in the Republican Party in the Senate who are willing to publicly criticize the president in an aggressive way. So with McCain gone, with Jeff Flake, his Arizona seatmate, retiring, you know, with Bob Corker from Tennessee, another Trump critic, retiring, there really are not that many voices in the Senate, you know, when you think of checks and balances, who are willing to stand up to Donald Trump and to call him out when they think he's wrong.
So let's quickly just shift pace just a little bit, because there was more news this weekend. The Democratic National Committee made a big change to the role of superdelegates in the primary election process. These are usually party officials or office holders that can vote however they choose for a presidential primary candidate. You know, what is changing there? What happened this weekend?
Well, the biggest change was that the Democratic National Committee, under the leadership of Chairman Tom Perez, voted to reduce the power and the clout of these superdelegates. These are people who are state party activists, who are members of Congress. Bill Clinton, former president, is a superdelegate. And so what they essentially did was they decided that these superdelegates could no longer support whomever they wanted on the convention floor for president. A lot of them bucked their own states and their own voters, and so voters maybe went for one candidate, and some of the superdelegates from those states decided on the floor or that they would support a different candidate, ignoring the wishes of their voters in their own states. And so you know, I think the bottom line is that this is really going to open up the process to make it more of an even playing field. You know, this is specifically a reaction to, I think, Bernie Sanders supporters who felt that party insiders very early on in that 2016 process had tipped the scales in favor of Hillary Clinton before many states had even voted. And so I think given the number of candidates we're expecting to see in the Democratic field for 2020, I think it's really going to open things up and make it a more even playing field. And it's going to be really a free-for-all with perhaps, you know, a dozen to two dozen candidates running for the presidency.
So this was a decision on behalf of the DNC, but I'm sure not everyone was on board. Who was opposed to this idea?
Well, I think some of the superdelegates themselves were opposed to it. Now, it was a voice vote, and so it wasn't a recorded vote, so we don't really know who specifically opposed it, but I think if you had that power, if you were one of the few who had those superdelegate powers and really could sway an election or choose somebody who you felt strongly about, even if your voters in your state were going in a different direction, I think those were the people who were most upset. But in the end, the party leaders decided this was best for the party, and as I mentioned, it was sort of a correction from 2016. And so they're moving forward, and they're hoping that the 2020 process will be better.
So I'm going to put you a little bit on the spot here, but how much of this do you think was a practical consideration or a little bit more about optics? You did talk a little bit about voters who supported Sanders feeling as though a lot of the sway was going towards Clinton. Is this kind of a saving of face?
Well, I think it's trying to appease some of these Sanders supporters who really, I mean, this is sort of where the base of the party is now. This is where the energy is. This is also about turnout for the 2018 midterm elections. And so they're trying to energize the base, get people to turn out for the election, not only in 2020, but in 2018 when you have the House and the Senate up for grabs. And so this is a move to say, look, we're listening to you. We've heard your concerns about how the process played out in 2016, and we're trying to make amends. And, they're hoping that the liberal base and the liberal activists who backed Bernie Sanders decide to show up in November.
Well, Scott, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yes, anytime. Thank you.
Scott Wong is a senior reporter at The Hill, where he covers House Republicans. He was catching us up on all of the top political news across the country.
Since the last presidential election, the national conversation has focused increasingly on life in rural communities, many of which have struggled with changing local economies.
There are lots of issues that factor into this, and they can all be pretty different, ranging anywhere from an older housing stock that doesn't accommodate a growing workforce to a town losing more and more of its young people to bigger cities.
One group that tries to tackle those problems and many more in western Wisconsin is Driftless Development Incorporated, an economic development organization that works to grow the economy in Crawford County.
Jim Bowman is the group's executive director, and he recently shared his thoughts on issues facing rural development with WisConTex, and he joins us now. Jim, thanks for being here.
Hey, happy to be with you.
So there are three main facets to the work you do with Driftless Development. Can you walk us through those?
You bet. So we are, as a nonprofit, focused on economic development. It's business development, plus community development, and really all multiplied by the leadership of the community. So our focus is to help businesses grow and thrive, first and foremost, at the same time trying to build an attractive community.
So it's kind of a two-pronged system, both spur business development, but also make the community a great place to live. And I believe that your slogan for your organization is working hard to make living easy. So can you talk just a little bit about how you guys work to make life easier for folks in the Driftless region?
Well, in Crawford County, where we really focus our work, the county has experienced a declining population. It's aging. We've lost some of our youth. Like a lot of rural parts of Wisconsin, we see lower incomes and of course work shortages and housing shortages. But the good news is we have an amazing place and a workforce that's as hardy as the landscape. We've got great companies here, great local governments, people that truly want to live here. So even though there's some challenges, it's a great place to build on. And that's what I see rural America is focusing on, place-based economic development.
That's really interesting, especially because there's been seemingly a lot of discussion about what to do with rural areas, rural cities, rural communities. I really want to quickly look at looking at this from the perspective of business owners. What have you heard from them about, some of the challenges that face them in building a business in a rural community?
Well, the number one, which is no surprise to anyone, is the tight labor market. It's extremely hard to fill job openings right now. So we in economic development, chambers of commerce, are working hard to help address that issue with creative programs from the non-typical job seeker to finding ways to solve child care services, transportation. Housing's a big issue of developing, growing the housing stock. And even how do we embrace people when they come to our community and welcome them and make them feel at home and connected, and such as young professionals and the youth. So we're having to be very creative. But our businesses, they want to continue to grow. Many of them have much more capacity that they just can't meet because of the labor force problems. So our job is to try to backfill that and help them every way we can so they can be very productive.
We are talking to Jim Bowman right now. He is the executive director of Driftless Development Incorporated, and he's with us to talk about developing businesses, bringing more people into rural areas, and some of what you were just mentioning, transportation, healthcare, stuff like that. There's a lot of outside hands in that, and some of that has to come from the state government or even the federal government. How do you work with municipal governments to try to spur that along?
Well, economic development by design has to be a public-private partnership, and also the private sector in large and small businesses and the public sector and local, county, state, even federal government. And there's important roles for all of them to play. And it's our job to kind of navigate through that process and with local government and helping them work on projects to successful fruition, of understanding the needs of a business that may need to move quicker and has to meet its customer demands. And then helping the business understand how the unit of government needs to operate with good policies and procedures and regulations that are there for public protection. So we often play the middleman and facilitate getting the deal done because we see both sides of it.
You're not new to this. You've been working in economic development for a long time, first in Illinois, now here in the Driftless region. What have you seen in terms of the needs of rural communities changing over the span of your career?
Yeah, quite a transformation, actually. More and more rural communities, one, are getting engaged in economic development. They understand that to survive, they've got to do something. And I would argue that more and more are getting engaged, and they're working regionally. They're joining forces. They're collaborating. They know they're stronger if they work with nearby communities and counties and form a region, speak in one voice for many reasons, politically or for policy, but even in how they help each other. Case in point, we just ran a zip code analysis of our 8 major employers and plotted them on a map. Well, that map shows that people come into Crawford County from 23 counties and 3 states to work here. So all 23 counties, we need to think alike in many ways, especially when it comes to the labor force.
So as we've mentioned before, there's been a lot of attention towards rural communities, but, sometimes people get it wrong. What is like one big takeaway that you wish that people across the state, people in cities maybe knew about the community you live in, communities you've worked in previously that doesn't get talked about?
Well, I think there's an element of urban folks that may want to think about living in rural America, and we're seeing that the urban environment's not for everybody, and there are those that want the lifestyle and everything that's offered here in the rural parts of Wisconsin and the Midwest. So a really important point, if I could mention, though, is broadband.
Yeah.
It's like the electrification of rural America. We've got to get broadband extended to all parts of rural America. It's a major focus for us here, and that levels the playing field for how we compete with the urban areas.
Jim, we'll have to leave it there for right now. We'd love to have you back, though. Thank you so much for joining us today.
You bet.
That was Jim Bowman, Executive Director of Driftless Development Incorporated. He joined us to talk about rural economic development in Wisconsin. You can learn more about this issue at wiscontext.org.
If you've returned to the smartphone market after your trusty older model of 3 years or so needed an upgrade, well, there's the first thing you might notice on first glance. One, the screens take up the whole phone now. And two, the prices take up a lot of your money.
Apple's flagship iPhone X will set you back a cool $1,000. And even more middle-of-the-road smartphones can still run upwards of around $500. So this got us wondering, just when did these things get so expensive and why?
And we want to hear from you, too, at 800-642-1234. How much are you willing to pay for a smartphone these days, and has that changed over time? Would you consider spending nearly $1,000 on a phone? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. David Pogue joins us now. He's a tech columnist for Yahoo Finance, and you may also recognize him from his appearances on PBS and CBS Sunday Morning. David, thanks so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
So is it just me, or are smartphones getting more expensive these days?
Well, it's a little trickier than that. The high-end phones are getting more expensive. That doesn't mean that middle and cheap phones aren't also still available. But yes, the iPhone X and the Samsung Galaxy Note 8 cracked the $1,000 barrier, and the new models coming out next month take it way up into the $1,200, $1,300 territory.
And what's pushing the cost of these phones up? Is it features? Is it the new materials that's being used in the phones? What accounts for this?
The biggest correlation with the rising price is the rising screen size. Screens are a really expensive component of these things. And what the public keeps saying is, we want bigger, bigger, bigger screens. As you noted, they've eliminated the margins, the borders on these phones. So it is proportionally more expensive to make a big screen than a small screen. And so the prices are going up.
And it's so weird, because for the longest time it was, we want smaller things. We want things that we can fit in our pocket. And now we want these huge phones. I mean, as someone who looks at technology, was this sort of a surprising trend to you when you started to see this happen?
Oh, it's so weird. Steve Jobs, who of course oversaw the beginning of the smartphone era with the original iPhone, fought and fought and fought to make this thing small. I mean, they pulled out every stop, every engineering trick to make the iPhone small. He would be horrified to see these giant phones that are coming out. But Samsung sought to compete with Apple with screen size. And so all these years, Samsung has offered a 5-inch model, a 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. They literally offer phones or phone tablets in every inch size there is. And Apple now has no option but to compete.
I'm also wondering, too, it seems like when I bought my first smartphone, I think I plunked down about $100 cash for it and I was good to go. Now I'm wondering, and that was me getting in the door, and I think for a lot of people, they're in the door with smartphones now. Is part of this that companies are trying to keep us on board? They know we're already hooked and we're probably not going back to that dumb phone anytime soon.
Well, here's one really important thing that has changed, and this is actually a tremendous win for you and other consumers. In the beginning, the phone cost $100 or $200, but that, of course, wasn't the total cost of the phone, which even in the early days was around $600. What Verizon or T-Mobile would do is they would bury the remaining $400 you owed them in the monthly price of the service. So they would hide the rest of the cost to make you think you got a $200 phone. The problem with that system was that once you had completely paid off the total price, guess what? They didn't drop your monthly fee. They didn't reduce it to just the service fee, which they should have. They kept collecting, which is really kind of sleazy. T-Mobile really broke that mold and said, that's ridiculous. From now on, we will tell you which part of your payment is the phone you still owe and which part is your service. And now, of course, Verizon and AT&T and everybody else has to follow that model. So that's why phones are $600, $700, $800, because you're buying the phone outright.
Yeah, I remember getting that plan and having to pay for it in the monthly installment, and it was great just putting a little bit more down. But yeah, we were paying for it down the road. And because you brought up contracts, I want to ask you, it seems like we have been trained as consumers to think that, okay, my 2 years is up, it is time for a new phone. Does that model still exist, and is that two-year number still right from what you're hearing?
The two-year contract is gone. Again, I have no financial interest in T-Mobile, but T-Mobile also broke that deal. They also said, that's ridiculous. Why should we hold you hostage? If you don't like our service, you should leave whenever you want. So now everybody else follows that model too, Verizon, Sprint, AT&T. Nobody has two-year contracts anymore. What they have instead, though, for people who always want the latest, greatest phone, all of these companies will now offer you basically a rental program where you pay, well, for an iPhone 6S, 2 years old, it's $19 a month. For a brand new iPhone 8, the latest model, it's $35 a month. You can pay that continuously, and then when next year's model comes out, you just turn that phone in and keep on paying monthly. So you never have a big $1,000 or $800 bill to pay. And a lot of people actually like that. They know what they're getting, and they know they'll always have the latest.
We are talking right now with David Pogue. He's a tech columnist for Yahoo Finance, and we are talking about the seemingly high cost of smartphones and what we're getting for our money. And speaking of that, David, it seems to me that, you know, when I upgraded from an iPhone 4 to an iPhone 6, I was like, wow, I notice a big difference. I have a big screen. My camera takes pictures that doesn't look like they were taken with a potato. If I upgraded to an iPhone 8 now, is it harder to sort of sell consumers on the new phone when they may not see the same jump as what they used to?
Oh, completely. If there's one job I would not want to have, it's the people who have to think up next year's new phone features. Because, I mean, anytime there's a new invention, whether it's a phone or a car or a refrigerator, the first years of this thing show radical leaps forward in features and functions. I mean, for the first few years of the smartphone, they added voice control. They added, I mean, the first iPhone couldn't record video, you know. they've made huge leaps forward. But now, I mean, here we are 10 years into the iPhone world, and it's harder and harder to put new things in there. So they work on better cameras, better speeds, better screens, but they really don't have enormous leaps forward like they used to. Look at a mature device like a refrigerator. You know, when's the last time you bought a new one? You'll go 10 years without buying a new fridge because they've reached stasis. They've reached the ultimate incarnation of what refrigerators are, and I sort of feel like the phones are getting there.
But I wonder, though, like if I go out to the store and I want to buy a new refrigerator, my mindset is still, I want to buy something that's going to keep my stuff cold, and that's it. But with a new phone, I'm like, man, I want something that's going to blow me away, and I don't know, like, for phone makers, what that is anymore, and is that why we're seeing, I don't know, stuff like holographs in your phone, or it'll scan your retina to allow you to sign into your phone, because they're trying to get that technology that wows people.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, the whole business model is you need to feel that your phone is behind the times once a year so that you'll upgrade. I mean, that's how it works. I don't know if you wanted to get into this next topic, but starting next year, all of these phone companies are going to be making a new pitch to you, which is 5G, that is the fifth generation cellular networks, which are opening up in big cities this year. And the first 5G phones will be available next year. And what they will offer is unbelievable speed. I mean, speed that makes your internet at home or even at work look pathetic. You'll want to leave the office to download big things. We're talking about 20 times faster in big cities, maybe 8 times faster in rural areas. But, of course, you need a new phone to get it.
I'm also wondering, too, it seems that, you know, when I go out and maybe about a year and a half ago, I had to buy a new laptop. And my mindset was like, okay, I can spend a little bit more on this because it's a laptop and I'm going to be using this a lot. And this is a major purchase. But like when it comes out, when I need to go buy a new cell phone, I'm like, oh, you want more than $200? I don't know about that. But I know that like deep down, I'm going to be using the cell phone a lot more. So I'm wondering, too, if you've seen consumers' attitudes towards value, towards the value we assign to our phones kind of change over time as we've become more reliant on them.
Well, that is the elephant in the room, really. That is how we all justify paying $1,000 for a high-end phone, is because what object in your life do you use more often? It's not your bed. It's not your car. It's your phone. I mean, you are on that thing on average 100, 120 times a day. So, I mean, that rationalization works for me. That's why I do it. I mean, it is the single most used object I own. Why shouldn't that be my investment?
I'm also wondering, too, as companies try to figure out, you know, the next big feature, some companies have been criticized for taking things away. I know people were sort of skeptical when the new iPhones came out because they were taking away the headphone jack. And I'm wondering, does sometimes with these phones, innovation come at the cost of taking away some things that people love?
For sure, especially with Apple. That's Apple's almost proud of telling their consumers they're idiots for liking a certain feature. I mean, Apple is the number one electronics company for introducing new standards. They introduced Wi-Fi. They introduced the CD-ROM. They introduced the mouse, not invented, but popularized. But they're also the number one company in taking things away, having introduced them. I mean, they took away the hard drives from our laptops. They took away the headphone jack from our phone. And it's not always necessary. I do understand their thinking on the headphone jack, because on the interior of the phone, that 40-year-old component took up about an inch of space that they could use for a bigger battery or better camera equipment. But somehow Samsung managed to keep it in for the next round, so I don't know.
And David, as we start to wrap up here, I would be remiss if I didn't ask you to speculate just a little bit here today. September is right around the corner, traditionally the month where Apple drops a little bit of a hint about what's coming with the new iPhone and then releases it shortly after. What can consumers possibly expect from the next generation of more expensive iPhones?
Well, the strong leaks out of China are that there will be three new iPhone models the second week of September. There will be a really big one, bigger than anyone's ever seen before, 6.5 inches. This will be like holding a VHS cassette in your hand for like $1,100, $1,200 with three lenses on the back, one of which can do a 5x zoom for your pictures. Then there will be a small iPhone 10-sized version, also fancy with a fancy OLED screen. And then there will be a budget model with an intermediate size, 6.1 inches, with an older-style LCD screen. All of these will be designed like the current iPhone 10. That is, the home button is gone. Now you will swipe up from the bottom of the screen instead of clicking a button. That lets them fit more screen onto a smaller phone, smaller being relative.
And we're going to have to leave it there. David, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
David Pogue is a tech columnist for Yahoo Finance. You may also recognize him from his appearances on PBS and CBS Sunday Morning. He joined us to talk about the price of smartphones and how much consumers expect to pay these days. And he was also giving us a preview there of the iPhones that are going to be coming out next month. This week, we are celebrating a big birthday for a little piece of plastic.
The Lego minifigure, or minifig, celebrated its 40th birthday yesterday. And you know what we're talking about. It's the smiling face, the claw hands, and the unnatural joints that conveniently plug into whatever Lego block happens to be sitting around.
While Lego had been designing human-like figures prior to 1978, it wasn't until then that they settled on the design that we all know and have probably stepped on today.
Oh, yeah. I think there's plenty to talk about stepping on Legos. But what's interesting, too, is that we seemingly all have our favorite minifigs, don't you, Chris?
I do. I love the ghost, and I love the astronaut that always had the helmet that had the little chip on the visor, which I love during the Lego movie when they actually replicated that with the astronaut yeah. character. They know, like, what's up with their minifigs. I will give them that credit. What do you think,
yeah,
JC?
Yeah, I'm a big fan of the Darth Vader one for some reason. I just like that.
I wonder why.
It's, well, let's be real. I love Star Wars. Love Legos, so it nice intersection there. But yeah, I always liked playing with those ones, the Star Wars ones, the best.
How many minifigs have you stepped on throughout?
Countless.
Yeah,
between me and my brothers, it was Lego heck.
Permanent scars. Well, coming up next, it's the news from NPR and WPR, and then we'll get an update on weather conditions around the state after storms and rainfall last night. I'm Chris Molina.
And I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.